has constrained our fellow citizens, taken captive on the high seas, to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. So far, the series has focused primarily on the Declaration of Independence as a land-based document. In other words, a document that declared sovereignty and control over the land that the 13 colonies occupied. However, the Declaration is also a sea-based document. It is as much a maritime document as it is a land-based one. By declaring independence over land, the United States was also claiming sovereign rights over the sea, as well as international recognition for its ships at sea. Let's not forget that the world of the 13 colonies was very much a maritime world, a world that looked primarily east over the Atlantic Ocean back to Britain and Europe, and not necessarily west across the vast continent of North America to California and the shores of the Pacific. Indeed, so many of the grievances in the Declaration, including the one you just heard, reference this maritime world. Grievance 16. King George has cut off our trade with all parts of the world. Grievance 19. He has transported us beyond seas to be tried for pretend offenses. Grievance 24. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. So again, the Declaration is not just about securing American ownership of land, but it's about establishing American ownership of the seas. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, destroyed the lives of our people. They weren't American seas until the Declaration claimed them. So today we are going to do a deep dive into the seas and look at the Declaration of Independence as a maritime document. How important was the larger Atlantic maritime world to the colonies? What was life like for merchants and seamen before the war for independence? And what was it like during the war? And what would this new maritime freedom mean for the new United States after the war? These are really complicated and fascinating questions, and I have a very special guest with me today to help answer them, Professor Denver Brunsman. Welcome, Denver.
Thank you so much.
Denver is professor of history and chair of the history department at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He is the author of many works on the American founding era, including the book, The Evil Necessity, British Naval Impressment in the 18th Century Atlantic World, published by University of Virginia Press. A link is in the show notes. So, Denver, let's just set the scene by trying to unpack my thesis here that we really need to understand the Declaration of Independence as a maritime document.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think stepping back even further, we just need to think about it as a political document, right? The whole purpose of it was really to persuade and to convince, to inform. And a huge part of the audience of the document, of course, are people in Europe, people in Britain, people in France, you know, enemies and potential allies alike. And as you say, in creating a new nation, these people had to think about, you know, their livelihoods and how they were going to make money, how, you know, what was the future going to be like. And at that point, you know, I agree 100% with what you said. They're looking east, not west. Not that they aren't looking west, but so much more commerce in their, you know, collective experience was connected to the seas and to trade with Europe, that they're absolutely thinking about that after independence.
And what was life like for a seaman living in, say, one of the great port cities of the colonies in those, say, pre-20 years, maybe during the French and Indian War, the 7 years war, up to time that problems really start with Lexington and Concord and then into 1776?
Yeah, for life for American sailors, I think like any Atlantic seaman was somewhat perilous. It was a tough job, a tough livelihood, and it was made even more difficult by war. At the same time, war presented certain opportunities. And you mentioned the Seven Years' War and just all the wars that took place in the 18th century leading up to the American Revolutionary War. You know, in wartime, sailors had the opportunity to make more money. Merchant wages went up, you know, because of the scarcity and the need for goods. But navies also needed men, needed sailors. And so the various European navies, particularly the British Royal Navy, was looking for men to impress. So as British subjects, American seamen could be captured legally by British press gangs. And so this was something that they had to certainly look out for. Now, after the Seven Years' War, after 1763, during the imperial crisis, there's really a separate, almost mini crisis for maritime folks, particularly sailors. And that's because in attempting to enforce the various customs regulations and in placing Royal Navy ships on the eastern seaboard, impressment continued even in peacetime. And this really violated the purpose of the practice, which was meant to be a wartime practice. And it really kind of raised a lot of questions, legal questions, questions about, you know, custom and what was right. And so this, you know, I think added to the difficulty of being a sailor this period in the 1760s and 1770s.
And just why don't you describe the horrible and yet you described it as sometimes legal process of essentially temporarily enslaving sailors. I mean, that's what it is. It's a temporary, and sometimes I suppose it could be permanent, and oftentimes you'd lose your life anyway.
Yeah, so impressment is, you know, one of those amazing British practices, almost like the monarchy itself that descended from the Middle Ages, and it really never went away. The basic idea was that a subject would, you know, trade their service in exchange for protection from the monarch. And that's, you know, the basic deal that was originally struck, you know, whether they wanted to serve or not. And so through time, you know, through custom and various acts, it basically became legal during wartime, during, you know, times of necessity. That's the allusion that I make in my book. And that's why it was especially problematic that the practice was taking place, you know, in peacetime, but before the Revolutionary War. But just real quick, what happened when a sailor was impressed, he basically had to stay in the service of the Navy through the end of a war. And so, you know, that was one of the things that differentiated it from slavery. A sailor would also receive wages, but it was definitely forced service. And one of the arguments I make, and I think I present evidence to back this up, is that it's the second most common form of forced labor in Atlantic world and in the 18th century. And it's a long distance second to slavery. And I, you know, no way say that it, you know, approaches the importance of that institution, but it was important in its own right.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to create an equivalence there, but it was a temporary form of very serious coercion. And arguably, you might have a longer life, although a miserable life as an enslaved person, than you might in the British Navy, where lots of people died, lots of sailors were dying quite frequently, not only from battle, but from disease. And maybe we'll talk about death and disease on the high seas later. You mentioned the word protection in what you were saying. There were certainly advantages of being a merchant vessel, flying something like an allied British flag on the high seas. Is that correct? I mean, it's good at the time that you are a British merchant vessel, even if you are like a colonial, because, you know, the British Navy had some weight. And you had to be very careful if you were a privateer or something and you go after a British flagged ship. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So the British Navy is the strongest fighting force really in the Western world at this time. And they have their own kind of tricky relationship with their merchant ships and merchant marines. On the one hand, they protect them and they protect that commerce. And that's what, you know, helped to make it so lucrative to be part of the British Empire. On the other hand, during times of war, they do become targets for impressment to capture sailors. And over time, the Navy had, you know, basically negotiated a certain deal, you might say, with merchant ships. And that is that they would take sailors, but not so many that it would disable those ships to prevent them from, you know, carrying out their trade. And so this is, you know, something that develops through trial and error over the course of the 18th century. And the British had pretty much perfected it by the Revolutionary War, by the end of the 18th century, finding a way for their commerce and their wartime, you know, manpower needs to coexist.
So you might not be impressed just at a port city on land, if you're at a pub or a tavern and suddenly basically they collar you. But if you're sailing on the high seas, a British warship could just stop you and be like, hey, we're taking 10 sailors. Is that correct?
That is correct. And that was the most common form of impressment, was actually at sea. And one reason from the Navy's perspective is that they really wanted skilled sailors. They didn't want just any warm body, which they would sometimes get on land. But, you know, we're a better place to find sailors than at sea. So that was the majority of the practice. This becomes important in the American context because it became especially controversial for British press gangs to work on land in places like Boston, New York, or Philadelphia. And, you know, the local communities over time had found different ways, particularly through rioting, to push the practice to sea. And so that was, you know, probably even more common in the American context.
And let's talk about maybe the British context quickly. Back on the British Isles, the practice of impressment also must not have been so popular. Is that correct?
It's very unpopular. Yeah. And this is something that I explore a lot in my work, is that I think, as you know, from my perspective as an American and working in the American Academy and, you know, within, say, an American historiography, you know, we tend to sometimes overlook the international dimension, the British perspective. And it wasn't uniquely American to oppose the press gang. In fact, it, you know, there was almost nothing more British than opposing the press gang, and that because it was very unpopular in British ports as well, where crowds would turn out. And so it is this practice that, in a weird, you know, kind of way, does link the Atlantic world, at least the Anglo-American world.
So also in the British Isles, impressment could only happen technically during war.
That's correct. It was a wartime practice. And there are these, you know, different cases, you know, various kind of what historians call phony wars, where there might have been mobilizations for a conflict.
Yeah. Well, this is what I'm going at. It seems like if you read British history, there's constantly a war happening. So was there actually ever really a pause in this process? Or if you became a sailor, did you basically know, sometime in my life, I'm going to be impressed? Because that's just what it seems to be. That's the reality.
Certainly in the 18th century, where war is so common, especially war between Britain and France, that I think a sailor would have to almost count on it happening at some point. And you do have these periods between wars, not always very long. One reason for impressment is that the country didn't keep a standing navy, that they demobilize. So in some ways, maybe something that's almost as bad as being impressed is losing your job, right? So this happens at the end of wars, and sometimes sailors will become socialized, they'll become accustomed to being part of the Navy, the war ends, and then they're out of work. And this is when you get piracy. Piracy happens in the Atlantic, and especially in the Caribbean, during periods of peace, because you have all these unemployed sailors, and a lot of them, you know, quite bitter at their former employer, both for capturing them in the first place, and then ending their employment. And so there's, you know, kind of an interesting relationship between those two institutions of impressment and piracy.
Just again, a sort of a social history question here. Obviously, people can choose different professions, right? You can be a farmer, you can be, I don't know, a tailor. In the colonies, you can go out and, you know, try to tame some land out west and become a hunter and a fur trader. Like, a lot of the stories that I've read about and everything I hear about being a sailor in this time, it was just a brutal profession. But there must have been some positives, or else, you know, people wouldn't do it. You know, if you had to describe any of the positives of this career choice, if we can use modern terms, I mean, what would it be?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It actually is a complicated question, because I think part of the debate among scholars about the maritime life and about sailors is how much of a choice it is, how much it's, you know, coerced by class and by economic conditions, where, you know, people might not have a lot of economic choice to begin with. There is a certain strand of scholarship that, you know, based on some evidence, particularly in the American context, that there is a certain sort of romantic aspect to going to sea, especially as a young person that might not have a lot of other economic prospects. And there is more social mobility in the American colonies than there was in Great Britain. So your typical sailor is different. The sort of classic professional Atlantic mariner is more likely to be born in the British Isles. That's the person that never really moves beyond the profession. Whereas in the American case, it was very common to have sailors that just, you know, would pursue different voyages just for part of the year, maybe 3, 4, 5 months out of the year. The rest of the year, they might pursue something else, you know, on land. They might be farmers, they might be artisans. So it's more of a part-time employment. And a lot of those sailors in the American context, you know, they would eventually maybe become masters of their own ships, eventually maybe become ship owners. And so there was that possibility. So I think that's part of the draw. And I'll just mention one other quick one during wartime, and that is privateering. Which is basically legalized or state-sanctioned piracy, where, you know, different ships could capture enemy ships, and they would be able to, you know, divide the proceeds. And even though the officers of a ship would get a disproportionate amount, someone could make a fair amount of money just as a common sailor. Adam Smith, the Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith, describe privateering as the lottery of the sea. So if you didn't have a lot of other options, you know, you buy the lottery ticket, go to sea and find out what happens.
Sort of one of the common threads that I've heard from all historians of whatever stripe is just one concept of labor shortage. The project of empire and the project of colonizing requires labor. And there's constantly this labor shortage everywhere in the colonies, just by necessity. How can you master new continents and islands and whatever without all this labor, which takes us then obviously into slavery and this and that. But you also just need, you know, people to do all sorts of things. And that's kind of why I asked the question about why choose, if you had the choice, choose being a merchant when your labor was so valuable in so many different ways. So there must have been a reason that if you had a choice, you would actually choose seafaring. It must have paid better than, or been slightly better than, whatever other profession you could do in Pennsylvania or Virginia or Massachusetts, yeah?
Yeah, and I think that's right. That the money was good enough. We can kind of put it in these terms, that the British Navy didn't have to force non-sailors into service. That, you know, the term that they used for them was landsmen. They actually had to turn away some of these people from joining because the amount of money, as you say, that they could make was more than any other unskilled labor on land. So, and that kind of gets to the myth of the press gang that I think in the popular conception, they would, you know, capture anyone they could, but they didn't really need to capture people that didn't know how to sail because, you know, they could have as many of those people as they wanted. On any given ship, they could only have about a third of the crew who didn't know anything, didn't know how to sail. There, you know, there's enough just labor, menial labor to go around, that they could make use of those people. And in the meantime, they would learn, they would train up, they would learn the ropes, mm-hmm. a nautical Literally. Phrase. Mm-hmm. But the other two thirds would need to, you know, there would need to be people with some seafaring experience.
So I would imagine it would be particularly dangerous to be a fisherman on the coast during wartime, because here now you're a fisherman, you have skills on the sea, you know the ropes, literally. So I'm guessing being a fisherman would be highly problematic if you wanted to avoid being impressed, yeah?
It would be. The institution is extremely complex. And in those hundreds of years that I mentioned, where, you know, the legality of it's being formulated, part of that is what was called protections. There's different legal protections against impressment. And you mentioned fishermen. That was one class in particular that was able at different points to carve out protections. Some were customary, some were statutory, you know, it varied. And so I think it kind of depends on how much, say you're a fisherman, how much you trust the legal system to, because one thing that would happen is someone would be captured, but then it became very complicated to get out. You could file a writ of habeas corpus, but you would need help with that. You know, you would have to be on shore. And so a lot of things can happen in between an impressment and a chance, you know, for a sailor to actually prosecute for his freedom.
What were the consequences of desertion? Let's say you are impressed and then you decide to escape.
So I think the worst consequences as in an army, a land army, would be death. This was highly, highly dangerous. But as we've been talking about, there is this maritime labor shortage, as there often was on land with soldiers. And so the Navy didn't necessarily want to execute, you know, their skilled sailors. So the amount of time that someone actually is put to death for desertion is it's relatively rare, but, you know, they have these performative cases to, you know, try to caution other people from deserting. And desertion is, you know, it's common, but it's maybe not as common as we might think. The figures that I use, based partly on my research and also the research of others, is that the British Navy in the 18th century, around 7% of sailors in the Navy desert. That number goes up during the American Revolutionary War. And one reason, I think, is because of the number of British ships near the American coastline, which was a particularly attractive place to desert to. And one thing I've traced as well is that the likelihood of desertion goes down significantly after the first year or so that a sailor's in the service. So in other words, if someone is impressed, they were a high risk that first year or so to leave. But I think this speaks to the success of the British Navy. They were able to integrate these men into the service well enough that they felt some camaraderie, some community. You know, in some ways, if we think about a gendered aspect, their masculinity was served by this profession, and they tend to stay after that first year.
You know, you just mentioned a gendered aspect of this, but also is thinking about desertion and the choice not to, say, execute a highly skilled sailor who deserted because he's much more useful being impressed again, as it were. And it reminded me of the episode we did about homosexuality in the colonies and the low number of homosexuals who were executed in the colonies, just because it would often be someone who was too valuable to the community. So they would prefer anything besides executing a person who had skills that were absolutely needed, because skilled people were so hard to come by. Again, labor shortage.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Yeah.
But let's move to, so we talked a little bit about the British Navy and impressment before the war. So Lexington and Concord happens in 1775. How quickly do we start seeing the British Navy going on a war footing and starting its practices, both in Britain and in the colonies, to start impressing people?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Navy is headquartered in Halifax, in North America at this time. And I think in that immediate...
And was that Lower Canada then?
Yes.
Lower Canada.
And that immediate sort of like outbreak of war, I think the most dangerous thing was to be Canadian at the time, to be a subject around that area. And there are a lot of, you know, British Canadian sailors that are impressed during the full conflict. Just as the army, the British army is caught a little, you know, flat footed, and they're definitely not at full strength at the outbreak of war, the Navy was the same. And it picks up significantly with Parliament's passage of the Prohibitory Act in December of 1775. And I think this is one of the most underrated pieces of legislation in the imperial crisis. And I think it's overlooked because it comes after the war is already started. But it's in many ways the closest thing the British have to a declaration of war against their own colonies.
So what did it say?
Yeah. So the Prohibitory Act basically makes enemies of colonial ships just like if the British were fighting the French, they could be captured, they can be taken. But in an important difference than an enemy like the French, the men on board could be impressed, because Britain doesn't recognize America or the new United States as a nation until the end of the war. So sailors were caught in this strange limbo where they were fighting the British, but the British saw them as their own, as subjects. And as subjects, they could be impressed. And so this is, you know, what Americans had to deal with. And this is where you get the 26th grievance to the Declaration that I, you know, read at the top of the program. And it's not the only time that you see this mentioned, but all the local declarations, the community declarations that are made before the actual Declaration of Independence, you know, there's close to 90 of these that have been identified between April and July of 1776. And the most common complaint in all these local declarations is war, the ways in which the king had made war on the American colonists. And we see that in the declaration itself, where the last five grievances, including the 26th, you know, leading up to the 27th grievance, all have to do with war. And, you know, this is really critical, because I think this is the most important cause of declaration. I don't think it's not like the American Civil War, where we can say just one thing causes independence, that, you know, slavery was it. It's a lot of things. But if it just in the immediate sense, in terms of the timing of the American Declaration, the war is very much on their mind. And I think that this Prohibitory Act had really accelerated that type of thinking.
Yeah, just so if you can unpack that legal regime a little bit more for me. So if you're a French or Spanish soldier and you are captured on the high seas, what happens to you?
So yeah, if you're a French sailor, soldier, you become a prisoner of war. And the British are going to imprison Americans, but they're never going to treat them fully as foreign nationals, foreign prisoners of war.
So, and as a foreign prison of war, you would not be impressed. You would get some sort of different and potentially better treatment.
Yeah, great. Now, this is a really, really critical point. The British didn't want foreigners in their, say, Navy or Army. And so they don't even actually think about it. They don't even ponder this. But when they capture the Americans, who they still see as subjects, who are, you know, basically committing treason, they can get a pardon from the king and serve in the Navy or the Army. And so if, say, someone is captured, there's going to be a lot of pressure put on them to, you know, you can either go in this miserable jail, either on land or the really miserable jails at sea, the ship jails off of the coast of the continent, or you can serve. You could, you know, actually join the British Navy. And thinking of that choice, you know, we don't have perfect numbers about how many actually agree to serve. But it's under, it seems to be under about 10%. So it's not nothing. A fair number of people do take that. And I guess you can interpret that different ways. You could say that, you know, there's actually a lot of people that leave the American cause to join the British. Or you could say, wow, given the what they were facing, maybe that's not so high.
Yeah, so, well, it wasn't a free choice. You know, okay, so they're captured and the British officer can say, okay, well, we're going to imprison you. Or you can join us. You'll get a pardon and you join us. But were they not executing them? Because if they are committing treason, are they just simply too low in the hierarchy to be, say, executed like, say, Jefferson, if he were captured after the Declaration, or Washington might have been executed for committing high treason as leaders?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think they would have just had to execute so many people that they are kind of caught in this weird middle ground where they're, I think you put it well, they're almost not significant enough to execute. And going back to our earlier conversation, that there was a certain value that they had and there was a certain hope that, you know, eventually they would be able to change their mind and they would serve. And the, you know, it was an open choice. It wasn't just at that point of capture. They could decide later that, you know, now I'm ready. So maybe the British are waiting for that.
And you mentioned the prison ships. Why don't you just give our audience a quick overview of what these prison ships were?
Yeah, so this is actually connected to impressment, and this point is often not made in histories of the Revolution. But in London and the British Isles, during a war, there'll be ships that, you know, they're called tenders, that their entire purpose is to hold men captive until they can be dispatched and, you know, put on different ships. So the British had done this for a long time. They had, you know, a lot of experience using ships as forms of incarceration. And so I think it just becomes quite convenient that they'll create these, you know, prison ships, particularly off of New York, are the, you know, most notorious ones, that will end up imprisoning, you know, thousands of men. And the conditions were incredibly unhealthy. The amount of disease, you know, disease was rampant and, you know, really, really high, death rates.
Yeah, it does not sound like fun. So we've been discussing the British practice of impressment. But I think one of the points that you would like to make in your research is that we can't just blame the British for this nefarious practice, that many times Americans try to avoid the history, but the American Navy, the new American Navy and American privateers would actually do the same thing. So why don't we just start talking about the other side of the coin, what the American Navy learned about British impressment during the war?
Yeah, so, you know, we have to, you know, the starting place is that the American people, the new American people, had been British subjects. And so they had, you know, lived under that system. And so there's so many of these areas in which the model that existed at the time is the British model. And so when ships need men, and there's not much choice, the American ships, you know, would impress. And we have, you know, there's two, I guess, broad pools that they took from. One were British sailors. That is, you know, sailors who had fought for the British and usually had become prisoners. The Americans didn't treat the British prisoners very well either. there's fewer of them, but they didn't treat them particularly well. And there are episodes of the war in which they will basically empty the jails and take men that way. And then there's, you know, taking American citizens. And this is really unpopular. It doesn't happen a lot. And it's usually rogue ship captains who, again, had been brought up in the British tradition. This is what they knew. You know, maybe some of them had even been impressed at some point in their lives. And so this happens. It happens in the Continental Navy, which isn't huge. It also happens in the 11 state navies. This is another thing that kind of gets lost in the histories of the American Revolution is we talk a lot about state militias and for good reason. There's also state navies and they would impress as well. But yeah, again, you know, say, you can see I'm very animated about this one, because I think it is kind of underappreciated and really interesting. But for the States particularly, you know, that's the one that I think people don't know a lot about.
Yeah. And so you said there was pushback. Why don't you just talk a little bit about some of the conflicts caused by either state or the Continental Navy trying to impress loyal American patriots?
Yeah, I think the pushback is as important as the actual impressment, because I think it does become one of the defining, you know, qualities of what it meant to be American in this era. And we'll see this especially, I think, in the War of 1812, even more so. But that, you know, what scholars call, you know, volitional citizenship, the citizenship by choice, that, you know, people choose to be an American, whereas, you know, in these European countries, and particularly Britain in this case, they're just kind of born into it and they're trapped. They can't escape the obligation. And so it is debated. Congress debates whether, you know, impressment should happen. And it's never the policy of the United States. So I think that's an important point, that they don't want to be defined by this. It is these individual ship captains that do it and are, you know, face some type of reprimand. The states are a little bit different. The states, you actually do get laws passed that allow for, you know, temporary periods of impressment of forced service. We see that in the militia as well. I mean, I think that the militias are coercing men more than the Continental Army.
I want to return now to the grievance that we started this with, and I just maybe think we can unpack it a little bit more, and maybe you have some stories to tell about this. So he has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country. So here what we have, what you've been describing. If you're an American merchant, you might not even be a naval sailor. You could just be a fisherman on a coastal village. Somehow the British Navy can come and force you to bear arms against your state, your colony, whatever. And in some cases, that might force you to become the executioners of your friends and brethren. So they can they impress you. Now you're serving on a British ship. And now they're going to make you kill your brethren, right? Or indeed, since you are in a British ship, you can be in a battle. And, you know, if the Continental Navy or a state navy wins, you might be killed by the hand of your own patriot. So you said, and this is what I think is so fascinating, all of this was already happening for quite a long time before the Declaration of Independence was released. So can you just tell me a little bit more about this history here?
Yeah, I love just hearing you describe that grievance, because it actually is one of the more poetic, maybe grievances in a way. I mean, it has a certain rhythm to it and very vivid imagery. And so one of the things that I argue is that this grievance probably wouldn't have existed without the Prohibitory Act. That's what this is really getting at. And one reason that that's, I think, interesting is that impressment had been taking place in the colonies by this point for, you know, more than 100 years. And so there was this long history with the practice, and it was never popular. But in some ways, in the bigger picture, impressment was what we might think of as a legacy grievance. It was something they didn't like, you know, in the first place about being British. And then, so then the question becomes, how is that politicized, or is it, you know, how does that factor into the decision for independence? And counterfactuals are difficult, hypotheticals are difficult, but I think without the Prohibitory Act, I think they might have just left it out. And the reason is not because they liked it or anything, but I just think it was just so ingrained. It was so part of their lives. There's so many other things about being British that they don't necessarily list as grievances.
Yeah, but I mean, one of the fascinating thing about the 27 grievances is how many there are. And you get the sense that Jefferson, if he wanted to, could have maybe done some light editing or added some more. But it's still just a huge list, and it makes its point. And I guess we'll never know why 27 was the magic number. And of course, the famous one that was left out could have been in there too, the one savaging the institution of slavery. Which brings me to my next point. How do we understand everything you've been discussing in African-American history?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think that the African-American, just African experience on the seas is so fascinating and so important. And it takes on really, really interesting dimensions with impressment. So I think, first of all, I think in this era, this sort of this early modern era defined broadly, for people of African descent, the sea has two big, broad, meanings. And one is of captivity, enslavement in terms of the Middle Passage. And the other is liberation, that a lot of people, enslaved people, find freedom, find escape through the sea, and also employment, that they're, going back to the need for sailors. British Merchant Marine employed people of African descent who were British subjects, who were, free people. That doesn't mean that individual officers didn't have slaves that they carried to sea, because that also happened. But if we kind of fast forward to the revolutionary era and the moment that we're talking about, people who are enslaved in the American colonies can actually escape by running to the British Navy. And so, I think it's important, and I think a lot of scholars have teased this out, to think about free and unfree labor along some type of spectrum where, enslavement is on one end, and then whatever we want to call entirely free labor is on the other. And impressment is somewhere in the middle towards the enslavement end of the spectrum. But I think it tells us that if enslaved people want to be impressed, that impressment isn't as bad as enslavement. And so it's just kind of an interesting way to think about social history and looking at the choices that people make in order to understand different institutions.
Yeah, and the story you mentioned reminds me of the story of Crispus Attucks, who freed himself in Massachusetts from enslavement and then joined a merchant vessel in Boston and lived basically a happy, normal life as a seafarer until, of course, he was killed in the Boston Massacre. And that kind of encapsulates a huge part of this history. On land, I know that with Dunmore's proclamation, the Royal Army, offered freedom to enslaved people who joined the British side. Was there ever such an open statement or policy by the Royal Navy as well?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And there's not. I think that it's the Navy, it's almost an unwritten open offer. And I think because of what I've been describing and what I write about in terms of this competition at sea for labor, that it was a little bit more anything goes. And to use a land term, it was kind of Wild West, it was at sea, just about anything went. And so I think that was one thing that made British naval ships attractive as places of escape. And it happened a lot. It happened to George Washington when, the HMS Savage is on the Potomac in the spring of 1781 and basically trains its guns on the Mount Vernon plantation. 17 of Washington's enslaved people run away. And they actually, and he spends years trying to get these people back.
Did they run away to join the ship?
Yeah, to join the ship, and there's a lot of different outcomes for them, and we don't know all of those, but I think, and we'd have to double check this, but I think that, within a certain number of years, I think he gets something like seven of the people back.
He re-enslaves the seven that he can find.
Yeah, exactly. So this was a very common practice, and not all of these people would become, sailors for the rest of the war and the British Navy. But as I said, there's a need for labor. Even if someone was unskilled at sea, there would be something for them to do on a ship.
And it's such an interesting history because despite the hardships of being at sea, it also seems like sometimes kind of a more generous lifestyle. That, you know, if you were captured in a naval battle and you were on the other side, if you're just like, hey, can you just do the ropes here? We'll overlook the fact that you were trying to kill me 5 hours ago, and vice versa. And I think your history shows that some people, I think I read in something that you wrote that one sailor actually changed side, was it 12 times?
12 times, yeah.
I mean, and it's just amazing. So, but what that tells me, or what that kind of indicates to me, is that since everyone knew this was such a strange world, you really couldn't take it personally if someone on another ship was shooting at you. They could just be doing it because that's what you have to do. And they kind of got that. They were much like more generous than we seem to be today with people who might be shooting at us.
No, I think that's right. It was normalized. And we talked a little bit about gender before. And there is this concept of the brotherhood of the sea where someone might be on the different side, but they're on a ship and they do speak that same language of the different, you know, the nautical language, even if they don't actually speak the same language. And so, you know, people really do move from ship to ship, from side to side. And this is one reason I'm a bit cautious in ascribing too much loyalty to American sailors in this era. I mean, I think on the one hand, I think, of course, there are what we would call patriots, strong patriots amongst them. And they were politicized by the practice of impressment and, you know, through the 1760s and 1770s. But these are also, you know, people that, like all of us, we're trying to get through the, you know, each day, trying to get through their lives. And at any given moment in a war, when different choices are presented to them, you know, serving on a British naval ship might be better than, you know, whatever the alternative might be, especially if it was imprisonment. And I think you described the Navy well. You know, in the armed forces to this day, there's, you know, the phrase hurry up and wait, that there's a lot of waiting. And there's hundreds and hundreds of men that serve on these larger British naval vessels. And so while the work is hard, it was actually harder to be on a merchant ship. You would have more work to do, less help. So, you know, I'm not trying to make it sound like this is cozy or anything, but there were worse alternatives.
Yeah, no, the reason I mentioned that was because we had mentioned in the language of the grievance how terrible it sounds that they are capturing people on the high seas and making them bear arms against their brothers. And yet, I don't know if a sailor would read it that way, with kind of that personal affront. You're affronting me personally. You're doing some moral indignity. It seems like it was so common to change sides that it's almost like an oath that Jefferson was overreaching when he was writing this, and he was politicizing something that was far less political in actuality if you were actually in the seafaring community. What do you think?
I think that's fair. Yeah, I think that's fair to say that that a sailor didn't write this, right? They might they might put it a little bit differently. And you know, one thing I argue is that I don't think I've found a skilled white sailor who was like happy to be impressed. That they, you know, that it is a disappointment for them. They tried, like I said, they resist, they try to escape, particularly within that first year or so before they become accustomed to it. But at a certain point, they did accept it, that it was something that did, that, you know, it was almost part of their profession.
Yeah, it just had to be done. Okay, well, let's get towards the end of the war now. In 1782, Parliament actually makes a decision to treat American sailors differently. Why don't you just talk about this political development, please?
Yeah, so coinciding with Parliament's decision to basically end the war against America, you know, while they continue to fight France, the sailors end up in a different legal category. And the way that we've been talking about it up to 1782 is that they were still seen basically as British subjects who had gone wrong, were, if not full outright treason, were in violation of, in their behavior. By 1782, they get treated like the French or the Spanish. They're treated like foreign nationals. And why this is important is that it opened up the possibility for prisoner exchanges a lot more easily. Up to that point, there's not that many sailors who are exchanged because the British, as we've described it, they see them as commodities and they see them as sort of in a different legal category. But once they're treated like foreign nationals, they can be traded.
That's also a sort of a first legal declaration by the British Empire that the American colonies are de facto free, even though the war isn't over. They're basically saying, well, now we're treating American sailors like the French or Spanish, who are foreign entities like these American sailors, which is basically saying we have to start acknowledging that the United States are in fact free and independent states. Is that correct?
That is correct. And it is an early sign. And so it's kind of fun if you think about it that way. And there's the famous story, and it's true that George III, pens the abdication message, after Parliament decides to end the war against the American colonies, because he feels like such a failure that he's lost these colonies. And
Can you just tell that story, which hasn't been told yet?
So I was one of the faculty contributors to a really wonderful exhibition that's at the Library of Congress right now called the Two Georges. And we're recording this during the U.S. government shutdown, so you can't go there right now, but hopefully that will end at some point. And one of the really neat bits of research to come out of that, and it was known before, but it's fleshed out in the exhibition, is that, when George is faced with the prospect of ending the war against the American colonies, he feels so distraught, he has so much despair, that he actually pens a message that he's stepping down, from the crown. And this is a document that still exists. And then he does what we teach all young people to do these days, and I guess even old people, and that is, leave things in the draft box when you're
don't hit you're send.
Don't hit send. Just wait. And that's what he did. I think he slept on it, and he decided in the end that, he didn't want to advocate. But my point in sort of raising it was that I think he understood your point, and that is that this was the end. That once you're gonna stop fighting these people, that their independence is inevitable, that that's what's gonna come next. The only question is the terms.
And so maybe just a penultimate question here. What did being independent in that sense when the United States declared independence, now France has acknowledged it, the British soon acknowledge it in the Treaty of Paris, what does it mean for sort of the maritime world that there's this new naval power? Did the founders like fully prepare for that, or were they just kind of doing ad hoc stuff? Like, I guess we need flags and we need to figure out our laws of the sea, all this stuff.
So following independence, there's a lot of opportunity for merchants and sailors, but also, it was definitely an unknown world for them. They had been within this protected economic system within the British Empire. We have to keep in mind that that's the very last thing that the American revolutionaries would accept from the British, is that they would, the last thing that they would consent to was the Navigation Acts. So they saw some benefit of being part of that economic system. And so they're really kind of, forging out on their own. And a lot of the British markets were closed or somewhat closed in the Caribbean and other places. And so we see increased trade to the Far East, to China. And there was a lot of, I think, a lot of pride in being an American sailor in that era. And part of it was because of impressment. They saw themselves as protected from that system. And so, first of all, everybody's happy when peace comes because nobody's getting impressed at that point. But then, within a pretty short period of time, the French Revolutionary Wars are going to begin. And at that point, every British sailor would love to be an American citizen. They would love to be on an American ship. And that's what prompts the whole events that lead up to the War of 1812. So many British sailors deserting to American ships.
And that is a fully other story, so we're going to leave it there.
That's going to be another podcast.
Yes, sir. Final question I ask all my guests. 250 years after the Declaration of Independence, what are your main takeaways?
Yeah, the big question at the end. Yeah, I mean, there's so many things. I think for our own society right now, and we're in recognizing this, I think my greatest hope is that the American public will appreciate some of the complexity that we've been talking about. And I realize that they're not going to grasp or even want to grasp all of it, but that this wasn't a simple good versus bad situation, that there's a lot of nuance. There's all kinds of wonderful histories that have come out in the past generation about the loyalists and how the loyalists consider themselves free and people who loved liberty. They didn't hate liberty. They just saw that it was achieved in a different way. And I think we can think about these sailors that we've been talking about, you know, in a similar way, that I think they were searching for the best outcome that they could for themselves, for those who had families, for their families. And oftentimes that crossed with being, you know, part of this new country, the United States. But sometimes it didn't. And their stories are important to tell as well.
Professor Denver Brunsman, thank you so much.
Thank you. A lot of fun. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The American Centrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the American Centrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.